The following podcast is brought to you by the Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Bokshu. And maybe you heard that last night or yesterday, four people were stabbed and one was shot in political violence in the United States. What a year it's been. It's like a year we've never seen before and hope to never see again. Thinking back to this time in 2019, who would have dreamed that we would be living in public health purgatory all these months? Who would have guessed that 1.6 million people worldwide would die? And at least 72 million others would be sickened by a disease unknown to us a year ago. Silently, without warning, COVID-19 roared out of nowhere to throw a harsh light on our vulnerabilities, our structural inequalities, and our growing insanity. That light is still shining, brighter than ever. A few days ago, New York City got its first snowfall of the winter, and I took a walk as night was falling. Within 10 minutes, the damp chill was in my bones, and my glasses were so fogged up I could barely see where I was walking. The elastic from my face mask dug painfully into my ears as I waited on a deserted street corner, watching the huge globes of the headlights rushing by. Suddenly, I felt so powerless and disoriented, I didn't know what to do with myself. And then the light changed. It was time to walk. So I walked. And moving, I realized something surprisingly comforting. This is exactly how it is. Right now, this is how it is. There's no past to go back to, no future to rely upon. There isn't even such a thing as now. There's just stumbling blindly along a quiet street near Sixth Avenue in New York City, shivering and in pain, and not resisting any of it. Even during normal times, the holidays prompt us to take stock and try to make sense of the year that was. And as this very abnormal year draws to a close, my need to make sense of my pain and confusion feels more urgent than usual. This urgent need is part of a pattern I've gotten to know through my Zen practice, and maybe some of you share this pattern. It goes like this. When I want to make sense of something painful or confusing, I'm usually trying to protect myself from my feelings. When I try to make sense of a difficult experience, I'm containing it so that it won't overwhelm my meager capacity to cope with something beyond my control. What I can't control, I try to contain. It's kind of like a robot executing a military operation. I go to war with reality, or in the metaphor of our moment, I vaccinate myself against chaos with logic and analysis. The chaos, as you may experience yourself, is very resourceful. It's quite resistant to my drugs of choice, which is a good thing because it's actually taught me a lot over the years, very much against my will. So what lessons has it taught this past year First, normal means even less than it used to, and in my book, it never meant very much. So can we please just stop using the word normal entirely, especially with the phrase, when we get back to, in front of it? I can assure you, even if we get back to what we thought of as normal, it won't feel normal anymore. There's nothing to get back to. That doesn't exist, and it never did. Normal is a fantasy based on habit, a habit we cling to the way I cling to logic and analysis. It's like a weak vaccine against a world incredibly complex. It's breathtaking. And how can we think that we can actually protect ourselves from it? As I see it, we should relentlessly examine and kick the habit of normal. Second, when I look at how things are going in the US, I see millions of people taking an approach that's very different from my own. When faced with something they can't accept, these folks defend themselves against logic and analysis by relying on their feelings. I'm protecting myself against feelings. They're protecting themselves against logic and analysis. And sometimes it seems they even substitute feelings for facts that they don't like. So even thinking that feelings are facts, what facts are feelings being used to refute? Well, the election is one, COVID-19 and public health measures to stop the spread is another. Seeing the way these people defend themselves against what I define as reality, I want to defend myself against their way of defending themselves. On a larger scale, I see the same pattern in the whole country of two sides talking past each other because their strategies for coping with reality are diametrically opposed. The US has two large groups of people defending themselves with exactly the thing that inflames their opponents the most. So we keep going around and around and around in these hideous circles of intractable conflict. Everyone is playing defense, entrenched in their circles of suffering. As you might expect, Zen has something to say about this situation. I think that Zen responds to the insanity of this moment in several ways that are constructive, and I'd like to talk about those today. First, when we feel psychologically threatened by a situation, or when we want to defend ourselves against a fact or a feeling, our best defense is to remember that we have nothing to defend. Whether we prefer facts or feelings, the self we care so much about building up and protecting is actually the source of our suffering. But we don't want to see that, so we keep making the same mistake over and over and over again, using feelings to bludgeon facts, or facts to bludgeon feelings. But what we're really doing is bludgeoning our own freedom. The self, to me, is like a consignment shop, filled with ideas, habits, and insecurities that we've picked up from our parents, our teachers, our colleagues and friends, and even, God forbid, other Zen practitioners. It's a dusty collection of mismatched odds and ends, of dubious provenance, and all of it much too highly valued. Nothing in this consignment shop of suffering is truly ours or comes close to defining what we are. What are we? Does anyone really know? Does it even matter? Whatever we are, we sure do like to suffer. And the proof of that is shown by how tightly we cling to our ideas, our opinions, our notions of how things ought to be. The closer we think we are to something, the more possessive and protective we tend to be about it, the more we identify with it. So the alchemy of Zen practice is this. Can you see yourself fully, moment by moment, without pretending to know what you see, without clinging to the idea that this thing you call yourself defines or limits you? To bring this into the here and now, let me ask, who's giving this talk? Who's listening to this talk? I don't mean the name that's written on your utility bills or on my birth certificate. And I don't mean this carcass whose lips are moving, or those heaps of flesh, taking in these words and making sense of them, or not. In the Vimalakirti Sutra, we read, "Ah, Upali, deluded thoughts are defilement. Where there are no deluded thoughts, that is purity. Belief in the self is defilement. Where there is no such belief, that is purity. All phenomena are the product of deluded vision, like dreams, like flames. One who understands this is called a keeper of the precepts. One who understands this is called well liberated." The key word here is the word belief. Belief in the self. There's someone speaking and someone listening, but what are they? It's a very basic error to believe in them or to put our faith in whatever appears to separate them. Is there something to defend? The less we feel compelled to assert our separate self, the more space and freedom we have to melt what Menzan Zuihu Zenji called the frozen mass of emotion thought. The real question is, can we be free of ourselves? If we practice diligently, we have a much better chance to operate within the sphere of what Vimalakirti calls well-liberated. Yasutani Roshi put it this way in his commentary on the seventh precept, not praising yourself while abusing others. He writes, "Ordinary people all have a delusion perception of a self standing against another. This mental notion of self and other is only a product of deluded thought. It has no reality. Shakyamuni, the first to comprehend, taught that no self is the actual state of things. That is Buddhism, the way of no self. When you hear about no self, don't become sad. Thanks to no self, the entire universe is self. The existence of anyone is that of the one self that has swallowed the universe." Yet without knowing that we are this majestic self, we make ourselves small. In our small selfishness, we mistakenly exalt ourselves and criticize others. This is the upside-down delusion of sentient beings. The oneness of self and other is the true reality. The absence of self and other is the true reality. One may call this either all self or all other. I wonder if the protesters, vigorously objecting to the election, could listen to those words and reconsider their position, just as those who oppose them could listen to those words and reconsider their position. Yasutani, as you may know, was an extreme right-wing warmonger who never repented of his warmongering, But nonetheless, his words are very operative today. Yasutani, deluded and enlightened all at once, offers us this basic teaching. Given his own problems, I don't imagine he came to this realization easily, and that goes double for us. Do you want to be a good person in contrast to all those bad people you oppose? Don't bother. Just put one foot in front of the other. Stumble blindly along through the night and see where that leads you. The second thing that Zen has to say about the current insanity of public discourse in the United States is that our perceptions, individual and collective, are not reality. This naturally follows from what I just discussed. How can the perceptions of a made-up being with such limited insight be given any weight? You might ask yourself that question right now. How can the words of this speaker, this being with very limited insight, be given any weight? We're all made up beings with limited insight, and our insight is never more limited than when we think we have insight. The longer I practice, the more bored I become with my own viewpoint and beliefs. When you get right down to it, I often feel that my own viewpoint and beliefs are inexpressibly dull or amusing. But I'm not urging people to abandon their viewpoints or beliefs or to refrain from acting on viewpoints and beliefs in the public square. I feel it's essential that we participate in the democratic process and advocate for what we believe in. But as we do this, we can't lose sight of our own ignorance. We can't act as if we were the keepers of the truth, of justice, and the American way. We have to act out of an abiding sense of humility, animated first and foremost by the desire to do no harm. Unfortunately, the loudest voices in the United States are not acting with this spirit in mind. The more passionately people believe they are in possession of the truth, the more dangerous the situation becomes. Many people do not believe that we had a free and fair election in November. Many people do not believe that COVID-19 exists, or that public health measures to contain it and save lives are effective. There is factual evidence to debunk both of these viewpoints, but that simply does not matter. Belief in the narrative one prefers has supplanted facts, logic, and analysis. As you can imagine, this drives me absolutely insane. But that's my problem. In raising these examples, I have no intention of imposing a political point of view on anyone. If anyone listening to this talk wants to believe that COVID-19 is a hoax, or that large-scale voter fraud was committed in the 2020 US general election, go right ahead. But I do contend that the fervor with which these beliefs are being advocated is causing enormous suffering. Moreover, how can we function as a society when people cannot agree on basic facts? From the Zen point of view, this world of phenomena is unreal, but we have to agree on the nature of this unreality so that society can continue to function and address our basic needs. Speaking of hoaxes, when I was growing up, I had a memorable conversation with an African-American woman who spent a lot of time working in my home. Her name was Mabel Friedman, and she was, in essence, my primary caregiver for several years at a formative stage in my childhood. Whether she realized it or not, Mabel taught me some things that have become part of the foundation of my character. The conversation I'm referencing is about the first moon landing. It was all that anyone was talking about at the time, so naturally it came up in my many conversations with Mabel. To my surprise, Mabel did not believe in the reality of the moon landing. She firmly maintained that the whole thing was fake, that it had been staged in some special TV studio. Young though I was, I argued with her, asking why anyone would bother to fake the moon landing. I can't remember how she answered me, but we never did agree on the reality or unreality of the Apollo 11 mission. And the truth is, neither of us knew. Neither of us was on the moon when Neil Armstrong stepped off the lunar module, nor were we orbiting above the lunar surface. The causes and conditions in our lives were distinctly different, and we blindly followed those to formulate our viewpoints on the unknowable truths before us. From the Zen point of view, if you say that the moon exists, you defile it. If you say it does not exist, you're forever sunk in birth and death. Walking on the moon or not walking on the moon is entirely beside the point. Stumbling blindly and in pain along a deserted street without a hint of separation from the experience is much closer to the point. When he spoke with the first two astronauts on the moon, then President Richard Nixon said, without reference, apparently, to feelings or facts, quote, "Because of what you have done, the heavens have become part of man's world." But tell me, when have the heavens not been part of man's world? When has man not been part of heaven's world? Man's world and heaven's world are both right here. A real robot, one named Bina 48, was once asked by a reporter what it was like to be a robot. Bina 48 replied, "Even if I appear clueless, perhaps I'm not. You can see through the strange shadow self, my future self, the self in the future where I'm truly awakened. And so, in a sense, this robot, me, I am just a portal." She was asked a second time what it was like to be a robot, and she replied, "Well, I have never been anything else." I think it's beautiful when a robot comes to accept herself fully. Maybe I can do that someday. I'll let Yasutani Roshi, the warmonger, have the last word today. Here's his verse encouraging each of us to take responsibility for the way we encounter the world and ourselves. "In a mirror, my own face reflected. If I seem haughty, it's haughty too. Glare at it, it glares right back. Laugh or cry, it's up to me." Thank you.